But let me just talk a little bit about the background of this year. So first of all, what prompted this year? Number one is there have been some Tanachshirim in the shul that have gotten lost this year with the certain people leaving. And Rabbi Korobkin thought it would be a good opportunity to learn another small book of Tanakh when I was done my Megillas Esther shiur, which was the other impetus for this year. Those of you who might have attended that shiur, I can see at least one and a bit people here who were there for that. That was a shiur meant to be about mainly reading the Megillah, but we talked a lot about the content of the Megillah as well. And it got me thinking, maybe we could do something similar. People really seem to appreciate that element of the shiur, that maybe we could do something similar with Megillas Rus. So to some extent, that's sort of set us up for this shiur over here. So that's sort of the background of how we get to this. Now, Megillas Rus is a very interesting Sefer in Tanakh. There are strong connections, as we're going to see, to Sefer Shoftim, and chronologically it happens earlier than a lot of the other books in Tanakh. It happens sometime during Sefer Shoftim, which is, of course, earlier on. The way I figured we would structure the next 5 weeks are as follows. I believe that it would probably be best, rather than provide introductions, which introductions tend to be generally written the last of anything that someone writes about something. Because when you're writing an introduction, you have to have a very broad view of what has happened within that book. So if I'm writing an introduction to Rus, I better know exactly what's going on in that book. If I don't, it's not going to make for a great introduction. So then rather than provide 1 week of introductions and saying, let's answer some of the bigger questions about Rus. What are the themes of Rus? Why do we read Rus on Shavuos? When did Rus take place? All of these questions are actually probably better answered once we've gone through the text of the Megillah together, and we can try and build answers to those very questions. And we'll be able to take details from within the Megillah that will actually allow for us to piece together that puzzle and to really have a deeper understanding of the book if we first go through the text and only then get to sort of the bigger questions, rather than having someone else who's gone through the text answer the bigger questions for us to begin with. So I think that that's a fair approach in terms of the weekly schedule. So we're going to do one perek a week, God willing. Now, another comment. Somebody told me and said, you know, Rabbi Spitz gave a shiur on Rus. I don't know if it was last year or 2 years ago. I'm interested to see how your shiur is relative to his. So that's the truth. Obviously, everybody has different styles. My focus tends to be to look at what the Megillah is telling us in terms of the pshat, and we can usually build off of that in order to get to some sort of drash. And there are a number of very, very excellent svarim, commentaries that were written on Megillas Rus files. One file is sort of an empty space after each pasuk in Rus. I've set it up so you have the Hebrew and the Koren Jerusalem Bible English translation. The one which is entitled Blank for Notes is a Word document. It allows, just basically every pasuk in the Megillah with a few lines for notes. It can be printed at some point and you can write on it whenever it is during this year, not during this year. You can use it on your computer. I've sent it as a document. The other one is the commentary of many of the Rishonim, so that you should have there in front of you. And those will serve as most of our sources. One other sheet I'm going to attach, it, time permitting today. If we have the time for it, I'm going to attach a small another sheet on one of the halachos that relates to the first parak of Rus. Rus is very interesting in that there is a huge wealth of halacha that actually is learned from Megillas Rus. Even though it's only a short, short Megillah, four chapters, there are many different areas of halacha which come up in Rus. And as a result, we actually have many different halachos that are derived from the story or that are hinted to in the story, and we'll point them out as we go through the text. But if we have the chance to elaborate on one of them here and one of them there, I think that will also be very nice. Again, that was something that people tended to appreciate when we ran things similarly in the Megillat Esther shiur. Okay, anything else? You can follow along in a Megillah. It's not going to be that different with whatever translation. They're probably best off. Okay, so let's get started. So the Megillah begins, Vayhi bimei shefot ha-shoftim. It came to pass, it was in the days of the Shoftim. Vayihi itself as a word is very interesting. More of the later commentaries, the modern commentaries, they Chazal also talk about it as a negative meaning. The question is whether it's used as an opening, whether it's used as a continuation. Does it mean to build off of something previous, or does it mean to continue? And it was in the days of Shifot HaShoftim, which is a weird grammatical phrase. What does it mean? The judging of the judges, that's normally, or when the judges ruled, that's normally how it's translated. Different Mefarshim deal with the grammar. There's a famous Midrashic approach to say that was a generation which judged their judges, or maybe when Hashem judged the judges, a few different ways to look at that. Vayehi Ra'av Ba'aret, the repeating of Vayehi may just be a grammatical thing, it may be for emphasis, and there was a Ra'av, some sort of famine in the land. Vayelech Ish mi Beis Lechem Yehuda, and a man went from Beis Lechem Yehuda. Man, generally, again, is sort of midrash, tends to usually be a term of chashivut, or significance in some way. In this case, obviously, we're going to see a little bit more about the man. The man's going to be identified. Here he's just given without a name, perhaps as a way of introducing the story. And he goes, mi Beit Lechem Yehuda, from Beit Lechem in Yehuda. As many comments, again, many of the more modern commentaries point out, there was actually another Beit Lechem. I believe it was in Zevulun. And he leaves from Beit Lechem to go lagur bistei Moav. The word lagur is some sort of dwelling, sojourning, living. It has various meanings. Sometimes it can initially mean just a non-permanent dwelling, sometimes a more permanent dwelling. And so he goes to do one of these things, bistei Moav, in the fields of Moav, obviously not literally in the fields, either in an open city that was out on the fields, but some of the modern commentaries look at it as. Some of them just say it means the country, which may have been perhaps flatter relative to Israel, or for whatever reason it was referred to as stay. There are many other places in Tanakh where we refer to an area as stay something. And he went to v'ishto u'shnei banav, him, his wife, and his two sons. Okay. There we go. So the pasuk then continues, pasuk beis. Second verse, V'shem Ha'ish Elimelech. The man's name was Elimelech, V'shem Ishto Naomi, and his wife's name was Naomi, V'shem Shnei Vanav, and the names of his two sons were Machlon V'chilion, and they were all Ephratim. Ephratim may refer to the place where they were. Ephratim may refer to the tribe that they were from, and again, we're told they were from Mibet Lechem Yehuda. The question as to why this is repeated, there does tend to be a nice amount of repetition in Megillat Rut in general, sometimes for emphasis, sometimes for just the way that it's being told over. The narrative of it tends to be a narrative that tries to bring people in. And Beit Lechem Yehuda here may be to emphasize that they were not from Ephraim. One way of looking at Ephratim could actually mean that they were from the tribe of Ephraim, saying, no, they were from Yehuda. Vayavo, Stemoa, Vayihu Sham, and they came to these fields. Vayihu Sham, according to most commentaries, indicates some sort of more significant living. If you look even in the Targum, the Targum talks about how they became officers, Vayihu Sham. But many of the commentaries point this out, that they remained there. They were there long term. At this point, I'm going to talk about a number of the things that come up earlier in the Psukim. Number one, we're not told why there was a famine. These are all places where we can really go off into Drash if we so choose. Right now, for the sake of time, getting settled, we're not going to. But you can see, based on how we interpret the Psukim, how you can have jumping off points to try to understand exactly what may have happened, why are we being told about this, and what details in the verses may contribute to this understanding. It's interesting. There's a Ra'av in a place called Beit Lechem. You know, there's a little bit of irony there. What can you do with that? Why might have there been a famine? Well, we might see from some of the other details. The other thing I want to talk about is the names in Rut. And it sounds a little bit funny when we talk about names, because of course we're talking about what we assume from a traditional point of view, and even from a non-traditional point of view, pretty much everybody assumes that we're dealing with some sort of historical narrative, that this actually, of course, took place. And if that's the case, the question is there any value in analyzing people's names? Because if those were just their names and those were just their names, there can't really be all that much meaning in the names of people if those were true names from a narrative perspective, if those were in fact their real names. However, Chazal Darshan names in the Megillah. Many people Darshan names in the Megillah. What's the purpose of that? So I think that there are a couple things to consider. Number one, we can learn from names as to what may have been going on in their time that caused them to be named this. So some modern commentaries will look for, you know, ancient parallels and who else do we see with that name and why might they have been named that at the time. So, for example, some modern commentaries will look at Machlon and Chilion, which technically seem to refer, at least in their Hebrew roots, to negative sorts of things. People look at Machlon from the Shoresh of Chole, sickly. Chilion is a destruction. And they might have said, well, perhaps this was because they were born at a time of famine and things were really bad. Or they might look at it and say, perhaps that's just how they looked when they were children. They may have been born and looked very sickly. So we can certainly interpret names in terms of what they might have meant at that time and why they may have gotten those names to begin with. On the other hand, the fact that Chazal darshan them about their lives, and the fact that we know for certain that the author of this Megillah changed people's names actually helps us. Later on in the Megillah, we'll see how at least the Redeemer's name, there's an anonymous Redeemer whose name might have been Tov, but certainly is referred to in the Megillah as Ploni Almoni. And that name is something that the narrator of the Megillah changed in order to give us a different perspective in the story. If that's the case, we would assume that Oved, who is one of the links, Boaz, who is one of the links in King David's line, might have been the name that they were known by. But these names might also have been created based on the characters that we have in the Megillah. So with that, Elimelech is a pretty straightforward name. Keli, as in my God, Melech, that's the way most of the modern commentaries go on that one. Naomi, from Pleasant, from Noam, Diracha, Diracha Noam. Some people think it's the feminine equivalent of Naaman, although there's also the name Naama, which is a similar name. And Machlon and Chilion is interesting, although many tend to view them as negative names, many view them as positive names. We see other names. You can look in Dot Mikra, which I found to be very helpful in preparing the Megillah, to see how these might be considered positive. For example, the word machol in Hebrew, which means a celebration or a dance, that might have been the root of machlon. Chilion, it could be completeness. It's not necessarily that these are negative, but there is value generally looking towards these names to see what they might indicate about some of the characters. And that's what, again, Chazal do and many of the commentaries do. But let's move on here without dwelling too much. For anybody who came in more recently, again, I'm going to try to repost the, just follow along in the Megillah if you can. When we get to the point that I'm, you know, if we get to the point that we're going to talk about the mitzvahs of the Megillah, I will try to repost that sheet for people to follow along with. If you have any questions, by the way, I'm going to get to check the chat every few minutes. So you're welcome to post them there. Ideally, if you can send them to me so it doesn't ding for everybody else, that's fantastic. But I'd be happy to take any questions. And now let's move on over here. Okay. Vayamot Elimelech ish Naomi. Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, passes away. Obviously, the fact that he is described as the husband of Naomi does raise some questions, especially in a society that was predominantly patriarchal, which is a theme that, again, a lot of the modern commentaries address. In this case, there are actually two main approaches that I've seen in the commentaries. Some look at it to say, yeah, this was actually something really bizarre. Naomi is the main character, certainly of the story, but maybe even she was very significant relative to him. And that he identified as her wife. Or the other approach that people take is that specifically he's identified this way when he passes to show how hard it was on her, that she really, really took this very hard. Oh, I see already emails coming in from people about this year. Oh, that's not something that we, just somebody that actually had this name. But yes, Kilion actually may be a positive name. So now you can return to that. But Tisha'er hiu shnei vaneha, and she remained her and her two sons. This is generally like remaining, like it's really bad. Obviously, at this point, we don't know how old Machlon and Chilion are. They may be very, very young. We see that at some point they get older, and in the next pasuk, Vayisulahem Nashim Moaviot, they marry Moavite women. This is obviously a major, major discussion amongst the traditional commentaries as to what was going on here marrying Moabite women. Was this a case where people were not only marrying non-Jews, but also marrying a nation, which we're told in the Torah is not allowed to marry into the Jewish people, even if they convert? Had they converted? Had they not converted yet? Obviously, at the end of the day, many of you may be familiar with the Gemara's Drasha on this very topic, which says that only male Moabites are not allowed to marry into the Jewish people, but female Moabites are. Nevertheless, the commentaries debate exactly as to what extent they may have been Jewish at this point, if at all. Some of the modern commentaries point out the word vayis'u, which raises a bunch of discussion among grammarians, because it's generally not a term that's used in so many of the early Sfarim of Tanakh, but rather a bit of a, oftentimes a later Hebrew word as to what it might mean here. Why was it used here? Some of them say this might have been without their mother's permission. They arose, took wives, not with the general lakach isha, which we see in other places in this very Megillah, but this may denote something else. Nevertheless, they married these Moabite women, Shem Achat or Pav Shem Hashenit Rut. So too here, we can go back to the Drasha train for what their names may have been. Again, if we're talking about from a purely strictly historical perspective, and we're assuming that these were their names, we're probably dealing with Moabite names, and therefore not really worth darshaning. Again, if we're thinking that perhaps these names may have been changed, for whatever the reason, within the Megillah to teach us a lesson, teach us a story, there are other interpretations. Orpa, from the root neck, whether she turned her neck when she left soon in the story, or perhaps because she's considered to be stiff-necked in some way, people float those ideas. Root is very hard to linguistically pin down. Many of the modern commentaries think it's similar to some Aramaic translation, which is re'ut, from friend. But there are other comparisons as well. You can see, I'd be happy to forward you to different Mefarshim who discussed this. Vayeshivu sham ke'eser shanim, and they dwelled there for 10 years. This, I should note, just from a pshat perspective, is very interesting. Was the entire time frame 10 years? Or was it just that after they married these women, the two sons lived there for 10 years? Something to think about, again, that you can work with this midrashically. There are a few approaches non-midrashically, but these are the types of details in the text that would be of interest to us, A, in explaining other parts of the Megillah, and I will try to bring this in, God willing, in the fourth parak, when we talk about one of the details of Ruth marrying Boaz and what this might have meant for that. But again, these are the questions that are sort of brought up by many of the Pshat Mefarshim, both modern and more traditional, and are details that we may not think of even, but I mean, this can change the time frame of what has gone on tremendously. Was it that they arrive in Moab and Elimelech dies, and then his two sons marry, and then they die all within 10 years, or could this have been for 20 years, 40 years? And it was just this latter part that took 10 years. Anyways, at this point, Vayamutu gam shnehem Machlon v'Chilion. Machlon and Chilion also die. This gam probably refers to on top of the fact that Elimelech had already died. V'tisha'er ha'isha mishnei yiladeha umei isha. And she remained, once again, the woman remained, and it's, you know, clearly trying to show how devastating it was to her, and how could it not be devastating, especially by noting the change in wording. Previously, we have hu v'ishto u'shnei vanav, v'tisha'er hi u'shnei vaneha, now mishnei yiladeha. These are her two children, but yeled is generally a younger child. That's how she felt. She felt like they were taken when they were so young, even though at this point they've been married at the very least for 10 years. Nevertheless, that's a terrible, terrible thing. Her daughters-in-law get up, and it says, Vatashov mistemav, she returned. Obviously, this can't mean that she literally finished returning. This is either she started to think about returning, she started to return. And why did she do that? Because she had heard from where she was in Stei Moav, in the field of Moav, that Hashem had pakad. Pakad is some sort of, it's very interesting to see how people translate it. Can be visited, considered, taken note of, come to the aid of, blessed, remembered. Again, all sorts of different translations that you'll see in various translations of the Megillah and in modern traditional commentaries. On the one hand, you're trying to say Hashem obviously can never forget, so how can you remember? But it is some sort of taking note of, that Hashem had taken note of his nation, Pakar Hashem et amo, latet lahem lachem, to give them bread. So she decides it's time to go home now. Did she independently decide that it was time to go back to Israel because of her circumstances? Quite possibly. We don't know, but something to consider. I'm just going to take a quick look at the chat, see if anything has come in. No. Okay. So let's continue at this point to go through the psukim. Okay. Vateitzei min hamakom asher haita shama, and now she actually gets to that point where she leaves. Okay, so before we said vatashov was sort of a beginning, a thought. Now she actually exits. Vateitzei min hamakom asher haita shama, that place which she was there. I'm just thinking now that that indicates like it was just that place. Like she really didn't want to be there. It was some, she doesn't even want to mention it. It was like terrible, terrible to her. Ushtei chaloteha ima, and her two daughters-in-law are with her. Vatilachna vaderach lashuv al Eretz Yehuda, and they took the road to return to Eretz Yehuda. Now, at this point, I think this is not something, again, that I picked up on, certainly when I was reading it the first time, but has been pointed out to me by some of the commentaries. At this point, there should be nothing suspicious about this activity. Not only is it a mitzvah in the Torah, but it was just common practice that people would escort someone, especially a woman who had gone through so much tragedy, that her two daughters-in-law, or really former daughters-in-law, I guess they remain daughters-in-law in this story, in that sense, even though obviously their husbands are no longer alive. We'll talk about the sort of some of the ancient views as to this relationship that remained a little bit later in the Megillah. But her two daughters-in-law accompany her, and at this point, it just looks like they're walking her out. They're being malave her to make sure either she stays safe or whatever the case may be. And they start to take the road that goes back to Yehuda. Many of the modern commentaries note that there are many roads that reach from Moab to Eretz Yisrael. It's unclear exactly which one they were on, and it probably doesn't really make a difference. It's the type of thing that, I guess if it was a long journey or a particularly rough journey, there might have been particular points where she might have said, okay, turn around, but either which way. Vatomer Naomi lishtei chaloteha. And now Naomi realizes something is up, and she tells them, Lechna shovna isha leveit ima. I want you to go back, and I want you to return to your mother's houses. That's where, really, traditionally, women who had lost their husbands would return back to live with their parents. Sometimes we have it Beit Aviyah, sometimes Beit Ima. It seems Beit Ima was a more appropriate place at that time, that women would generally go back to live with their mothers as opposed to their fathers, per se. And that's what's mentioned here. And Naomi says, really, she's got nothing but positive words for them. She says, Ya'as Hashem imachem chesed. And I tried to take out all the shemos for the Megillah, so that way if you print it out to write notes, you won't have shemos sitting around. Many people will still put it in Geniza, but just in case there are many Rabbanim, and again, I don't know the current stock of all of your Rabbanim, but many Rabbanim say that if you just printed this out as something non-permanent, if it does not have the name of God in it, then you would be able to just put it in a paper recycling. Either way, Yas Hashem Yimachem Chesed, she blesses them and she says, may Hashem do Chesed with you. Chesed can also be translated in a whole different bunch of ways. It's something obviously that's a big deal, which comes up in this Megillah. We'll see it referenced here. We'll see it mentioned many, many other times. But Naomi says to Ruth and Arpa, Yas Hashem Yimachem Chesed, may Hashem do loyally, favorably. So here's the list: loyalty, faithfulness, commitment, devotion, loyal love, good, any sort of thing. That's what Hashem should do to you. Kasher asitem im hametim v'imadi, just as you have done with those who have passed and with me. There's a question: is this two separate goodnesses? Meaning, some, especially the modern commentaries, lean towards saying that which you have done properly to me is also, sorry, that which you have done properly to your husbands was a chesed to me, whatever it may have been. It may have been bearing them. It may have been the conduct towards them when they were alive. Other people want to say these are two distinct chesedim. You can see the different commentaries that you have in front of you in terms of the traditional views. And again, I'm happy to provide reading material for anybody who wants other commentaries that I drew from. at any point in time, again, just ding me in the chat or send me an email. I'm happy to talk about that. Okay, let's move on. So, Yitain Hashem Lachem Umtzena Minucha. This is a grammatically awkward sentence. I don't want to delve too much into, you know, the nitty-gritty of grammar here, mainly because I'm not that, you know, good a grammarian. But nevertheless, it's, you know, questionable as to what this means. The vast majority of commentaries go with, may Hashem give you the following, which is Umitzena Minucha, that you will find rest. Minucha can mean rest, security, a home. What it actually means here is Isha Beit Isha, each of you in the house of her husband. She's telling you, you know, may God get you remarried. Again, in those days, this was of utmost importance and would have been the biggest blessing that she could provide. Vatishak lahen, and she kisses them. This is very interesting. Kissing in this story is actually a sign of departure. That's really what it's meant to be. That's what a lot of the commentaries point out. Obviously, it's departing from someone who you love, but it's a kiss goodbye. Vatisena kolan vativkena, and they lifted their voices and they cried. Now, is this just Ruth and Arpa? Is this also Naomi? It doesn't really matter, but details to think about. Vatomar nala, and they actually say back to her, ki itach nashuv le'amech. The word ki here is a little bit funny. Generally, it's translated as no. It's not one of those traditional meanings that you're taught of ki. There's a Farashi and Chumash, which talks about all the different meanings of ki. Here, really, what it means is they're telling her, yeah, but no, we're going to come back with you to your nation. The traditional commentaries here and throughout this entire conversation try to look for links. Had they previously converted? Had they not? Anytime it says nashuv, what does that mean? Does that mean that they're coming there for the first time? Does it mean that they're returning there because they used to be there? We'll talk about that a little bit more in the coming psukim, but again, something that the Megillah puts out there for us to work with. Batomer Naomi. Okay, so after hearing their response to her saying, no, we're coming back with you. We weren't just escorting you till now. We're actually going up to Israel, to Beit Lechem with you. Batomer Naomi Shov Navanotai. Please, please, return. And it's interesting, the modern commentaries point out this merging of words is Shovna. She's on the one hand telling them to return, but they're still like daughters to her. It's very, very tough, clearly, for Naomi, as we're going to see in the coming psukim. And there's this tension. She's telling them, I think it's better for you, at least according to the standard, you know, of what we're going to be reading. It's better for you to remain here or to go back to your mother's house to get remarried. Lama telach Naomi, why would you come with me? Ha'od li vanim b'me'ai v'hayu lachem la'anashim? Do you think I have more children? More sons in my womb that they will be to you for husbands? So this raises a tremendous discussion in terms of the halachic elements of the story, which I'm going to get into just a little short while now. What this brings to the forefront, and I see we have so this is exactly the, very nice. So many Mefarshim do pick up on that. Thank you, Dr. Sam. You will see various, once you go through the text, it allows you to think of various other parallels in different stories in Tanakh. And there are many people that have looked to draw upon those parallels to teach us stories, to teach us lessons, sorry. But that would be a very good one, which I believe I saw people pick up on. So just in terms of, ha'od li banim v'me'ai v'ayu lachem la'anashim, so I still have children, sons that I'd be able to get you married off to. So this brings immediately to the forefront the question of something that we know of as Yibum. Okay, the laws of Yibum are, if unfortunately a couple cannot have children and then the husband dies before they are able to have children, and this may be immediately after marriage, there will be a special relationship. The Torah dictates that the brother of the deceased actually has to perform either Yibum or Chalitza. Yibum would be to marry his deceased brother's wife. Chalitza would be to perform a different type of ceremony which releases them from this, and that would be something that people think of. Wait, is Naomi really here saying that she's, you know, that they're thinking that she's going to have more children so they can marry the brothers of Mahlon and Chilion? Meaning Naomi's going to say obviously that that's ridiculous, number one, She's probably fairly elderly at this point. And especially in the society that, and as broken as she is, everybody hands down agrees that this is not something that people are considering. What she's about to suggest is rhetorical. And that's really what she's going with here. But the conversation does start as to what are the laws of Yibum here. So by Torah law, the way it's interpreted by Chazal, there is no Yibum to what we call Eshet Achiv Shelo Haya Be'olamo. Again, the husband's brother who is not yet alive. There's no relationship of Yibum there. And even all of the modern commentaries, and frankly, even the very anti-traditional and heretical commentaries, even they do not say that this was actually the ancient Yibum. Even they agree that Yibum was not relevant here. But nevertheless, she said this as like a nice way, meaning if it was in my power, and as we saw earlier, she says, go back home and get married. If it was in my power, says Naomi, I would find you husbands, even if it was my own sons, but I can't. But this question as to Yibum and various other halachas really does come up a lot in the Megillah, and we'll hopefully get to touch on it here and there when it is relevant. So, and at this point, she says, she repeats herself again, probably for emphasis, Shovna v'notai lechna, return, my daughters, go, and show, shuv and lech is something which goes together, ki zakanti miyod l'ish, I'm too old to have a husband, ki amarti yesh li tikva, even if I would say that I have some hope, we know what tikva is, gam hayiti alay l'ish v'gam yalad tivanim, even if I were to tonight, be married tonight, be with a man tonight, have children. Again, the various commentaries say when exactly would this be, but at the end of the day, no matter when it is, ask Naomi a rhetorical question. Halahin tisaberna ad asher yigdalu? Would you really wait until they grew up? Halahin tiagena? Would you remain chained? Livilti hayot liish, to not marry anybody else? Are you going to really wait X number of years? Even if I were to have sons right now, would you really wait? Al benotai, no, my daughters. Ki mar li me'od mikem. And this is a very, very hard phrase to translate. You'll see a couple of suggested translations in the, or one actually, in the traditional view. The modern commentaries come up with quite a few different ways of reading this. One way to read it, and I'm just going to pull those up for myself here on my notes on the screen. So one way to read it would be either I am bitter because you are widows, meaning you remaining unmarried is bittering me, mar li me'od mikem, because of you. Another way to read it might be I am more bitter than you, ki mar li me'od mikem, my bitterness is greater than yours, perhaps because she lost more, or she felt that she lost more, and she actually did lose more. She loses two sons and a husband. That's pretty, again, not to in any way diminish the loss of a husband or a parent on behalf of Ruth and Orpah. But nevertheless, she says that, or Marli Me'od Mikem, some translate as my bitterness is too much for you to bear. You can't handle my bitterness. I would prefer that you don't accompany me. In explaining why she might be more bitter than them, others say that she would be unable to get married, and she's saying at least you guys have the opportunity to be, make something out of this for yourselves, again in those terms, and therefore don't accompany me, ki yatze avi yad Hashem. And depending on how we read that previous statement, we'll be able to read this statement as well, but basically again Hashem has punished her in some way over here. Fine, vatisena kolan vativkena od. They raise their voices, they cry again. Is it just a second time? Is it even louder? Is it on top of the first time? And in fact, Vatishak Orpa lachamota. Orpa kisses her mother-in-law, which as we said is a sign of her leaving. And the pasuk doesn't say it explicitly, but she leaves. Virut dovkava and davkava, and Ruth actually remains with her. Some modern commentaries take this as a very strong clinging. Others just say it's in contrast to Orpah. Orpah left, Ruth stayed. There's nothing special about it. When you get to even wilder takes, you hear all sorts of interesting and frankly silly theories. But anyways, let's not dwell on those because they're probably not worth going into too much detail about. Okay, Vatomer. At this point, Naomi has not given up yet in getting Ruth to go back. Hine shava yivimtech el amah ve'el Eloheha. She says, listen, your sister-in-law, which is what the word yivimtech means, has gone back. Okay, there's a lot of discussion of the grammar here. This is one of the classic examples of how where the emphasis on the word is can actually change the meaning of the word. Bali Kriya, take note. But the word is mila el is on the first syllable. Hine shava yivimtech, not shava. And that actually changes the meaning, the tense, whether it's past or present. El amav el Elohan, she returned to her nation and her gods. The modern commentaries have a lot to sort of figure out here in terms of what it means, ama and Eloheha. They talk about the connection generally that people had. Possibly when you got married, you adopted the religion of the person you were marrying. Possibly other people note that Eloheha may mean her gods. And they talk about, well, we know the Moabite god at that time was Chemosh. Would Tanakh use a plural for non-Jewish gods with the word Elohim or not? Or is it really singular? A lot of discussion about that, technical, but worth noting. And Naomi's message is, she's gone back to her nation. Shubi acharei vimtech, go back after her. After her may mean literally following her, or now that she has gone back, you should be going back to Vatomer Rut. And Rut responds, and again, I'm just going to check the chat here for a moment. Nothing else has come in. Okay. And Rut responds to her in something that can be interpreted in also a few different ways. And she says, Al Tifki'iv. The root, Pe Gimel Ayin, can be interpreted in a number of ways here. So one way to look at that would be like language similar to prayer, vayifga b'makom, but it can also mean to hit. Ruth may have felt hurt. Stop doing this to me. Li'ozvech lashuv me'acharayich, to leave you behind. And it's important to know this whole scenario is probably causing Ruth to be less comfortable with leaving her mother-in-law than she would otherwise be. She sees how vulnerable, how sad, how bitter she is. And she says, I can't leave you. Lashuv me'acharayich. And again, this is obviously a play on words with the previous pasuk. Shuvi acharei vimtech, lashuv me'acharayich. I can't do that. This Megillah in particular plays a lot with the Hebrew. Sometimes with irony, sometimes with repetition. But she says, I can't do that. And here she gives her promises, which again, if we were to have time today, then I would go into this particular area of halacha that we derive from the coming to psukim, but I will not, because we won't have the time. For wherever you go, I will go. Uvasher talin yalin, wherever you sleep, I will sleep. Ameich ami, your nation is my nation. Velokayich elokai, your God is my God. Vasher tamuti amut, wherever you die, I will die. Visham ekaver, and that's where I will be buried. Both traditional commentaries and modern commentaries try to deal, especially with these last ones. What does it mean, I'll die with you? It may mean in the land that we are both going to together, that's where I will remain until the day I die. Misham Ekaver, especially in those days, there were family burial plots. And even now, you know, this still stays to some extent, usually not so practical to have many generations all buried in the same place. There were specific areas, and she was saying, I'm part of your family, I'm remaining part of your family, that's where I'll be buried. Others note that there may have been this notion, and again, there's nothing wrong with saying notions that were non-Jewish at that time, because Ruth came from Moab. To whether this is authentic Jewish tradition or not, I don't know. There definitely is, you know, things that you've heard over time. Being buried together with people means you go to the afterworld with them, you go to Olam Haba with them. Again, I'm not here to debate the merits of that from a traditional Jewish point of view, just that this may have been something that she was intending. Ko ya'aseh Hashem li v'cho yosif. This is a language of promise. May God do such and such to me. Ki hamavet yafrid b'niu v'neich. Most commentaries render this as it will only be death that will separate between us. Meaning the only thing that can stop us from being together is death. At this point, v'tere ki mit'ametet hi l'alechet ita v'techdal l'daber eleha. Naomi sees ki mit'ametet hi, she was, the translation that we have here from Koran is she was steadfastly minded to go with her. Mit'ametet is a language of strength. Either she was very strong. Other people look at it, and I think this is actually very true. that sometimes by trying to talk someone out of it, you actually make them more serious and more into what they're trying to do. And it could be that Mita Metzed is that she was growing stronger from all of the different words of Naomi, as we had mentioned, that she's seeing how much of a nebuch Naomi is, and she says, I have to follow you. And Naomi says, you know what? Vatechtal ledaber eleha. She left off speaking to her. It's interesting to note, I didn't see any commentaries that said this, but the simple way to understand this is she stops talking to her, period. It's clear from all of the commentaries that they understand this as she stopped talking to her about that matter, meaning she continued on and she said, come with me. This is great what you've done. You could have viewed it as like almost an angry, like, I'm not talking to you, and that she still doesn't necessarily give in at this time. But however, we do see in the next pasuk, which is probably what prompts that explanation, Vatilachna shtehem ad bo'ana beit lechem, but they walk together. They go together as one until they come back to Beit Lechem. Vayahi, and it was, again, this is this word Vayahi, the word Hine, always calling attention, again, whether it's linking to the past, whether it's starting something new. Vayahi kivo'ana Beit Lechem, when they arrived in Beit Lechem, vatehom kol ha'ir alehen. The entire city, the city was astir. The entire city was astir over then. Vatomarna hazot Naomi, and they said, is this really Naomi? You know, can this be the same woman who we knew here from so long ago? There are various midrashim, by the way, that you'll see in the Mefarshim quote that I've given you in the Rishonim document. Again, midrashim trying to fill in what was happening here and how God has prepared things. All important and all good. Let's stick with the shot now. They say, is this going to be Naomi? And here we get another play on words, like we saw earlier. But Tomer Alehen, she said to them, Al tikrena li Naomi. Don't call me Naomi. What does Naomi mean? As we said earlier, something pleasant, something nice. Kirena li mara, she says. I want you to call me bitter, which is the opposite of her name. Ki hemar shakai li meod. For Hashem has made me extremely bitter. We saw earlier, kimar li meod mikem. This was her language that she was using. Many of the modern commentaries try to figure out why the change in the name of Hashem. It's interesting because at its core, that question is something that's often dealt with by traditional commentaries to say, well, Hashem is midas harachamim, and Elohim is midas hadin. Here it's really the modern commentaries that all try to pick up what is shakai, where is shakai even derived from. It's meant to be somewhat poetic. We generally see shakai separate from kel shakai, only in poetry and similar type situations. And what you're going to hear is that she's repeating this over and over again. And here she summarizes her situation in the next pasuk. Ani milei'a halachti. I left full. Now again, the Mefarshim debate, what does this mean? Does it mean she was wealthy? Which is certainly going to be a theme for the rest of Megillat Ruth. Does this mean she was married? She had children. Virekam heshivani Hashem, and Hashem has returned me here. Really empty-handed. Lama tikrena li Naomi. Why would you call me Naomi again? Pleasant, happy, good. Vahashem anavi. And Hashem has testified about me. This phrase is very hard to parse, to explain exactly what it means. There are two major approaches. Either that, you know, an angel must have testified in front of God to my sins, and therefore God has punished me in this way, or God is testifying that I am evil by punishing me in this way. Either of those is okay. Some people try to switch it towards a similar word, ina. Sometimes both, I mean, academics like to do this because they want to say the nekudos aren't correct, but sometimes mefarshim do this where they say a similar word, even with different nekudos, can sometimes have a same meaning as another word. You'll see this in various midrashim, but we'll also, you know, I'll take read this, ala this, and they say ina, actually, which means to afflict. The problem is ina never comes together with followed by a beis, so that doesn't quite work here, but nevertheless, it's Hashem punishing her. That's the main idea by testifying against her. Vishakai hirali, and Shakai, that same name, has harmed me, has afflicted me. Batashov Naomi, and Naomi returns. Viruta Moavia kalata ima hashava miste Moav. Again, double language here. What's that trying to bring out? What's that trying to prove? People have different theories. Vehema ba'u Beit Lechem, and they arrived in Beit Lechem. bitfilat ktsir seorim at the beginning of the barley harvest. Just to note, by the way, when that is, if we look, you know, and you want Hebrew dates, if you want English dates, you can get both. It's probably somewhere around the beginning of April. It's the end of Nisan. Again, you can see exactly when this was. I believe there's a Medrash which says that they arrived there on Pesach. But this is what had happened. They arrived to Beit Lechem. And this is sort of the summary sentence of what has just happened in this parak, which is going to lead into the next parak. I see we do have a few minutes left, and I see we have a couple of chat comments. Right, so we mentioned actually Vayivkava Makom there. I'm seeing that now. I'm a few minutes late. I said I check the chat every once in a while. At this point in time, I'd be happy to take any questions. If not, I'll summarize for you outside. I don't think there's a point in trying to reorganize some of the different sources. You can look at the source sheet afterwards, but there's a very famous Gemara, and I'll share it on the chat for those who get it. For those who didn't get it, I emailed you at the beginning. I included that in the email to you, this sort of extra sheet, which we're certainly not going to get through in full, but nevertheless, I'll invite you to look through it. It's what I called it the Ruth Tier supplement. But again, I'm happy to take any questions over the chat as well in these last few minutes. What I wanted to do, as I mentioned at the beginning, is to look also at some of what has been happening in terms of the mitzvos that are described in Megillas Rus. In the Megillah, we have various references to different mitzvos that are taking place. And if that's the case, what do Chazal do with these descriptions of mitzvos? The reason why this came up is because Rus, because she is a very, very famous convert, we actually learn a lot of the halachos that pertain to conversion from her story. Specifically, there was a back and forth summarized by Rabbi Dr. Mark Shapiro. I do believe he has smicha. It was his book that was being criticized. He responded to it. And part of his one in his book, he discussed the Rambam's 13 principles of faith and how they were a summation of Jewish dogma. And you can see this in the first paragraph. And the question is, when Rambam described the rules of what you tell a convert, he says the following. You can see this in source number 3 on the source sheet. Again, you're welcome to follow along. But basically what he says is you tell them the Ikarei Hadat, the fundamentals of the Jewish faith, Shehu Yichud Hashem, the Isur Avodat Kochavim, Umarichin Badavar Hazeh. You talk about the unity of God and the prohibition against the worship of false deities, and we elaborate on this matter, and we inform him about some of the easy mitzvot, some of the more severe ones, and we don't elaborate on that. We inform of the transgression of not leaving Lekach Chikhan Peah, and we inform them of the punishment given for violating the mitzvot, and this is how the Rambam describes it. Now, all of this comes from the Gemara, except for this detail about the Ikarei Hadat. The major points of Jewish faith, of the Jewish religion, or basic Jewish philosophy 101, or what we would assume, if I were to ask any of you, what should we be teaching potential converts about Judaism? We might have suggested the Yod Gimel Ikrim, the Rambam himself, if he came up and really formulated the way that we have these 13 principles of faith. If we're teaching someone who's entering our faith something, we should probably be teaching them all 13. But yet the Rambam doesn't make any reference to the fact that there are even 13. He just says 2. And so there was a question, does this indicate in some way that the Rambam changed in some way from this formulation that he had made earlier or not? That was part of the discussion. On the one hand, there was an indication that the Rambam should have mentioned. Many commentaries on the Rambam ask this question. They say, what happened to the Yod Gimel Ikrim? Why aren't these being mentioned for converts? On the other hand, there are many others who said, the Rambam just doesn't require that. Why not? So one way of answering this, and some Mefarshim just said, because he requires those two, and that maybe take it for whatever evidence or leave it for whatever evidence of the Rambam's formulation of 13. There are others, though, who point to the story of Rut. And they say it's Amechami Velokayech Elokai. That's the source of it. In fact, that's the Gra on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Rambam. On this formulation, and that was the source of the back and forth. You can look at the sources there. I brought you various Hebrew and English sources. It does seem that this may have been the source for the Rambam based on another Rambam that I brought you down there, but we'll call it here. I'm happy to stick around and take any questions from this point, but thank you all for coming out here for the first cheer. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in future weeks. Thank you very much.